It's Cam's first in almost 20 years, and it most likely won't be her last. Will she ever get used to the idea? Will she ever stop rolling over in bed every morning, expecting to see his head on the pillow beside hers? You know what I want? Debbie interrupts her thoughts again. Ice cream? Cam asks hopefully. That's what she wants, pretty much any time of the day or night, actually. No, I feel like a frozen piña colada. That's strange. You don't look like a frozen piña colada. Yeah, that's what Mike would say. One of his favorite corny jokes. It always made Cam smile. What do you think? Debbie asks. Isn't it kind of early for happy hour? She waves Cam off with an, it's 5 o'clock somewhere, right? Debbie stretches her toned body lazily and flexes her tanned toes with their glossy coral pedicure and a gold ring on one pinky over the sand. Slender, dark, and on the short side with delicate features, she's effortlessly beautiful. Sitting next to Debbie, when one feels more and more like a beached whale, is no picnic. It's a good thing Debbie, quick, friendly, confident, sharp-witted, is immensely likable. Cam is glad Debbie is spending the summer on the island. Well, her kids are here full-time anyway. Debbie's on vacation through the weekend. She returns to work on Monday, and a hired woman will be staying here with the kids on the days and nights she's traveling. That's how she phrased it, a hired woman. Debbie said she met her by chance, that she cleans houses in the neighborhood and mentioned she was looking for more work. Cam can't imagine leaving Tess with a virtual stranger, but figures Debbie must have no choice. Maybe her parents are too old or frail to help her. I've got a can of Bacardi mix in the freezer and a gazillion of those little airline bottles of rum, she tells Cam. Should I shoot back up to the house and make a pitcher of drinks? Doesn't a frozen piña colada sound good? It sounds a little too fattening for me. Good one. No one looking at Cam, and not knowing she's pregnant, which Debbie does not, would argue that she doesn't need to watch her weight. Her stomach is growing more and more difficult to camouflage beneath the oversized hardcover on her lap and the oversized white Terry Beach cover-up that's become her uniform lately. Oh, who cares about the calories? Debbie asks. Live a little. Should I just tell her I'm pregnant? Cam wonders fleetingly. No, not before she tells Mike. Okay, then. Should I tell her I'm newly sober? No. Like the pregnancy and the fact that she's sometimes haunted by disturbing visions, that's too personal to share. Cam settles on a flippant, if I drink rum this early in the day, I'll fall asleep. Good point. Me too. And who doesn't love an afternoon nap? Debbie decisively shoves her pretty feet into flip-flops and grabs her beach bag. Can you keep an eye on my kids while I go whip up those drinks? She doesn't bother to wait for a reply. Cam watches her amble off down the sand toward her rented first-floor duplex, just a few doors down from the Hastings' cottage. What do I do when she comes back with those drinks? Just say no? Get up and leave? Tell her the truth? What would Kathy advise her to do? Work the program. That's all Kathy ever tells her. She goes around spewing AA mantras as if they alone hold the key to righting what's wrong in Cam's world. That's why Cam has guiltily ignored her sponsor's phone calls these last few days. Not only that, but she hasn't gone to an AA meeting, down here or back home, in more than 10 days. Why should I? It's not like I'm going to fall off the wagon this time, she thinks stubbornly, glancing down at her belly. No way would she risk harming the child inside her. It's that simple. Is it? That's Kathy's voice inside her head, not her own. Yes, it is, she retorts. She believes in herself, even if Kathy doesn't. Lately, Cam's found a strength she didn't know she had. It's not as if she doesn't long for an escape every day. It's just that she'd rather crawl into Mike's arms than into a bottle. Why hasn't time dulled the ache of her marital separation the way it's dulled the thirst for liquor? If anything, she misses Mike more painfully with every long, lonely, sober day that passes. She misses him here at the beach. She misses him on the long drives back to Montclair with Tess for her weekly visitations. She misses him whenever she walks into the still, empty house they shared. Most of all, she misses him when she sees him, always from afar, in his car, in the driveway. He waves, she waves. They don't talk. But we have to. And tomorrow's the day.
So it really is you. I can't believe it. To what do I owe the pleasure?
Lucinda looks up to see Randy standing in the doorway of the small, deserted waiting room. Detective Randall Barricat of Long Beach Township Police Department, to be more specific. But to her, he'll always be just Randy. Nothing more. She learned long ago, the hard way, that more, any kind of more, where Randy is involved, is out of the question.
You owe the pleasure to the usual, she tells him lightly, standing and meeting him halfway for a tight, quick hug, an old friend's hug. Nothing more.
You mean the I'm on a case kind of usual, or the I decided to come to Long Beach Island for some sun and sand kind of usual?
Have I ever been the beach bunny type?
Hell no.
Randy steps back and flashes his dimples at her. Black-haired men with dimples and blue eyes are her weakness. That's how the whole damn thing started in the first place. With her weakness. And, to be fair, with Randy's. It ended because of his strength, if transferring to an out-of-state job shows strength. She initially thought it was weak and cowardly, running away. It's been 3 years now. Long enough for Lucinda to realize Randy's decision to leave really was best for both of them. Not having to see each other meant not living with temptation on a daily basis. 3 years, and a string of relationships and breakups with other men, later. Lucinda has a feeling she could pick up right where she left off in the temptation department, where Randy is concerned.
Tell me about the case, he says.
Missing child.
Aren't they all?
Not all, but most. He nods.
Neil got you involved?
He always does.
I wasn't sure if you two were still working together or...
Randy shrugs, having been out of touch for a few years now.
So how is he?
Fine. Irma retired last month, but Neil's nowhere near ready. And they have 5 grandchildren now, and a 6th on the way.
That's great.
Yeah.
So you see Neil a lot still?
She nods, eager to dispense with the small talk, afraid of where it might lead. She doesn't want to discuss her personal life with him, and she sure as hell doesn't want to hear about his.
So there's a connection to Long Beach Island with this case? He asks. That's why you're here?
There might be.
So can I help you? Is that what you want?
Is that what she wants? Lucinda isn't a woman prone to wishy-washy statement or sentiment. She always knows what she wants and finds a way to get it. Randy lifts his left wrist to check his watch. His gold wedding band glints on his 4th finger. Still there, in case she was wondering. Hell yeah, she was. So now you know all you need to know about his personal life. You might be able to help me, she says. I'm not sure.
Wishy-washy. Ugh. Not her style. Are you hungry? Randy asks.
Always.
He laughs. Right. I remember that about you. The tiny little thing with a trucker's appetite. Where do you put it all?
She sees his eyes flick up and down her body, not inappropriately in the least, and only for a split second. Still, she feels her face grow heated, remembering.
Come on, Randy says. I'll take you to lunch. Nothing beats Long Beach Island chowder.
You used to say nothing beats a Philly cheesesteak.
Yeah, well.
I used to say a lot of things. She knows him well enough to read the thought. Yes, and he knows Lucinda well enough to keep it to himself. Open that door, even after all these years, and she'll step right through it. She never was one to back down from a challenge. But that's not why she's here. She's here to bring Leah Roby home,
or maybe just to bring some kind of closure to her family. It has nothing to do with her own unfinished business with Randy. The fact that the Robie Trail led here to Long Beach Island is nothing more than a colossal coincidence, if one believes in such things. Lucinda used to, but the more she works in this business, the more she realizes there are never any true coincidences at all.
Interesting. Viewed with the naked eye from this perch amid the dunes, the Atlantic appears deceptively calm today, a crisp, even shade of greenish blue. But of course nothing, seen from a distance, is ever what it seems. Only when one looks through the newly purchased pair of binoculars is there evidence of the mighty rip currents that churn beneath the surface. Only via a magnified lens can one glimpse the true palette of splotches that make up the shimmering veneer, not just green and blue, but also purple and gray and a murky charcoal shade in one spot, the shadow of a cloud, perhaps, or a school of fish, or a prowling marine predator. Ah, closer to shore, hardy swimmers seeking relief from the heat splash about or stand chatting casually in waist-deep waves, seemingly heedless of the cold water, not to mention other hazards of the sea. How brazen, when one considers it, this breed of ocean beachgoers really are. Don't they realize that the moment you let your guard down, an errant tide can sweep you perilously far from shore? Aren't they aware that lethal creatures lurk and hunt in the water's chilly depths, creatures that crave the scent of blood and feed on human flesh? The binoculars tremble in sheer anticipation of a triangular fin abruptly breaking the surface to slice into shallow water toward the swimmers. That could happen any time, without warning. Wouldn't it be a sight to behold? This, after all, is the very beach where, almost a century ago, a great white shark slaughtered an unsuspecting swimmer before moving on up the coast to do it again, and again, and again. Even inland, in a creek in Matawan. That was an anomaly. A man-eater couldn't possibly dwell in those benign waters, or so the naive residents of that small, sheltered town believed, until the creek waters ran red with the blood of a ruthlessly slaughtered child. Standing on line at a crowded Lexington Avenue deli around the corner from his office, Mike feels his BlackBerry vibrate in his suit pocket. He pulls it out, checks the screen. A new email from Kate. The subject line reads, "Tonight." In no hurry to read the message, much less respond, he shoves the device back into his pocket. She said she was working from home today. He'll call her there later. Or not. He glances back at the sandwich board above the counter. As a regular here, he pretty much knows the menu by heart. The sandwiches are all cleverly named after local sports stars. Heroes, heroes. Get it? Got it. Long over it. But the hand-holding Midwestern honeymooners in front of him are captivated. They take their sweet time dissecting their options, exclaiming over the prices, and inanely discussing the weather, too, oblivious to the lunchtime crush, the counterman's impatient glare, Mike's growing frustration. His BlackBerry vibrates again. This time, a call. Kate. Again. He ignores her. Again. Maybe he should just cancel their dinner. He needs to get on the road by 4:30 tomorrow morning to beat the morning traffic. Traffic. Once upon a time, he and Cam joked about how they had become a typical suburban New Jersey cliché. Traffic seemed to define their lives from the moment they moved across the Hudson. There were certain things you just didn't do if you could help it, like go near the Meadowlands on Sundays in the fall, drive east through the Lincoln Tunnel on a Monday morning, or west on a Friday evening. Usually they could avoid all of it, change the schedule or the route, take a train, stay home. Not anymore. Not Mike, anyway. And he and Cam haven't joked about it in ages.
Mike's visitation schedule with Tess means he spends almost as much time sitting in the legendary Jersey traffic as he does with his daughter. Tomorrow promises to be a vehicular nightmare. Hordes of people head down the shore every year to kick off the holiday weekend. The earlier he picks up Tess, the better, since they've got a few additional hours' drive from Long Beach Island down to D.C. After much deliberation, he'd decided that would be a fitting place to spend the most patriotic national holiday. Years ago, when Tess was a little girl, he and Cam talked about visiting Washington. Now he and Tess are going without her. They're planning to watch the parade along Constitution Avenue, attend the concert on the lawn of the Capitol, and cap things off with the fireworks above the Washington Monument.
"You must be so excited about the trip," Kate commented when he mentioned it to her over brunch last Sunday.
He isn't so excited, but he pretended to be. He pretended, too, not to notice Kate's wistfulness about her own lackluster plans for the 4th. He also ignored the blatant hints she was dropping by the time brunch drew to a close. She mentioned that she'd spent a lot of time on the Jersey Shore in the past and was thinking it would have been nice to head down sometime this summer. She all but invited herself to catch a ride with him tomorrow morning. He knew that if he offered, she'd manage to wedge her way into his D.C. plans as well. Ridiculous. Did she actually expect him to ask her, a woman he's dated a handful of times, to spend a long weekend with him and his daughter? Apparently she did. He's recently discovered that single city women of a certain age can be a little desperate. Even beautiful, successful, independent women, like Kate. 39 and never married, she's a corporate brand manager with a corner office, a designer wardrobe, and a two-bedroom co-op in an Upper East Side high-rise. Kate is the polar opposite of Cam, in every way. Which is pretty much why he asked her out in the first place. It's also why he's going to stop seeing her after tonight. She's not Cam. She's nothing like Cam. And I miss Cam. At least he can freely admit it now, to himself anyway, after trying to deny it for months. There's nothing wrong with missing the woman who's been a part of your life for almost 2 decades, the woman who shared your bed and your bank account, lean or fat, the woman who gave you life's greatest gift, his daughter. Tess hates this, the separation, and all that goes with it. The one-on-one precision scheduling, the stilted conversation over dinner for two, the constant shuttling back and forth from Montclair to Manhattan, and lately, from the shore to Montclair to Manhattan and back.
Now, what does a BLT have to do with sports, and why is that hyphen in there?
Wonders the clueless newlywed wife in front of Mike, gazing at the menu. The hyphen is a typo, replies her equally clueless husband, who's clearly never heard of the Giants' Lawrence L.T. Taylor. Mike and Cam saw L.T. play years ago at the Meadowlands on a crisp October night, not long before they were married. Monday Night Football. Someone gave them the coveted tickets. He no longer recalls who it was, or which team the Giants faced, or whether they won. What he does remember? Cam's rosy cheeks, sharing a cozy plaid wool stadium blanket and a thermos of hot chocolate, how she screamed herself hoarse by the 4th quarter.
"I want to know what a grilled Thurman Munster is," the newlywed wife declares.
Mike checks his watch. If he doesn't get back to the office, he'll never get out of the office. "Grilled Munster cheese," her husband replies, kissing the tip of her nose. "You're so cute." Maybe Mike should just tell Kate he has to work late. It's the night before a long weekend. She's a businesswoman. She should understand. Yeah, she should. But will she? Kate can be persistent. She's the one who came after him in the first place. It was raining, and he came out of his office building to hail a downtown cab, as he always did when he worked late. She was already standing at the curb, trying to hail a cab herself.
"I'll make you a deal,"
she called from beneath her umbrella, a straight-shooting stranger with great legs.
"If I get a cab first, I'll share it with you. If you get one, you share it."
Either way, they'd ride together. There is no escaping her.
Yeah, and admit it. You were flattered by the attention.
Okay, he was. Who wouldn't be?
You're such a cliche, you know that? The newly separated man whose head spins at the slightest glance from a beautiful woman who isn't your wife. But the novelty is wearing off fast. Another cliche.
Shouldn't it be Herman Munster?
Mike hears the wife ask her husband.
For God's sake, Herman Munster was a sitcom character.
The newlywed tourists turn to look at Mike.
Thurman Munson was the greatest Yankees catcher ever, he adds, as if he's just trying to be a helpful local.
And if he's not beyond annoyed with their cluelessness and their youth and their blissful cooing and canoodling. They exchange a glance with each other, then look back at him. He realizes they see him for what he is, an impatient, type A, divorce-bound New Yorker. And an asshole to boot. The ultimate cliché. Wordlessly, Mike turns and pushes his way back out of the deli. Outside on the street, the midday sun glares. Grumpy office workers skirt around meandering tourists. Snarled traffic inches and honks. Sirens wail in the distance. From a nearby construction site, a jackhammer rattles incessantly. The whole nine New York City yards. And Mike's damn BlackBerry buzzes again. He leaves it in his pocket and makes his way back to the office, missing Cam and wondering what the hell he was thinking when he left. Wondering, too, what might happen if he told her he wanted to come back.
Mom!
Cam looks up to see her daughter waving at her from across the sand.
We're going to get ice cream. Be right back.
She nods and watches as Tess and Debbie's daughter, Beth, both wearing bathing suits and shorts, but in very different ways, walk toward the dunes. Seagrass sways there in the incessant breeze, a weathered board fence missing pickets and crazily tilted this way and that marks the sandy path off the beach. Tess disappears, and Cam pushes back an irrational stab of fear. She still can't shake the vague worry about her daughter, though she hasn't had any specific premonitions about her. She wants to believe that the frightening episode in the car that day back in Montclair was related to Tess's emotional pain, and nothing more than that. Yes, she's almost positive that the vision was purely symbolic, or maybe related to the cut on Tess's foot. Nothing more. But she does keep seeing that red-headed girl with the braids and silver necklace, standing against the blue wall with the red letters. L.F. The vision washes over her when she least expects it, bringing with it a growing urgency and a frustrating aura of familiarity. Why? Is it that Cam has seen the girl somewhere before? Or does she know the place in the background? The snippet of a scene never lasts long enough for her to figure it out. Trying to grasp it is as futile as building a sandcastle in the path of an incoming tide. So she tries not to dwell on it. Lord knows she's got plenty more to worry about. Tomorrow, Mike arrives at the cottage to pick up Tess for their 4th of July trip. Before they hit the road, she plans to pull Mike aside and tell him she's pregnant. Not the ideal scenario, but what choice does she have? The news has to be delivered in person, and time is running out. Her stomach is literally getting bigger by the day. By the time Mike gets back next week with Tess, it will be too obvious. Then he'll accuse her of hiding the pregnancy from him, and God knows what else, and things will get ugly. Better to get it right out in the open tomorrow, then let him absorb the situation while he's away. Maybe they can tell Tess together when he gets back. And she'll react. How? It's hard to say. The child Cam once knew so well has become a mercurial stranger at times. She doesn't share much, not with her mother, anyway. Beth probably knew more about what's going on with Tess 5 minutes after meeting her than Cam has been privy to in a year. Cut off from her so-called friends back home, Tess bonded with Beth, who's in the same boat, in a way only 14-year-old girls can. It usually takes a little longer for grown women to let each other in, at least back home in the upscale northern Jersey suburbs.
There, only Kathy ever really reached out to Cam, but not necessarily because she wanted to be friends. More likely because she sensed a kindred spirit, someone in trouble, and wanted to help. There's not a whole lot of benevolence about Debbie, with her bouncy brown ponytail and quick smile. But that's okay. She was friendly to Cam from day one, and Cam welcomed the companionship. Debbie quickly introduced Cam to a number of her friends, almost all of them divorced single moms. At first, Cam assumed Debbie had known them all much longer than she has Cam, but that turned out not to be the case. In the 2 weeks since Debbie's arrived on the island, she's developed a brand new social circle and treats everyone in it like an old friend, Cam included. Already, she's joined Debbie and her friend Petra for a pedicure one day this week, and the following morning had breakfast in town with Debbie and her friend Gina. Hanging around with a bunch of single mothers has made her own situation seem a little more bearable and almost universal. Funny, she never realized just how isolated she was in her suburban life. The alcohol had dulled the loneliness, just as it had numbed everything else. Now that she's been sober for more than 3 months, she realizes just how much she'd been missing. Maybe when she gets back home, she'll look up some of her old friends, the moms she used to know from the playground and PTO at Tess's old school. Amy, Lisa, Janice. No, Janine. Wait, was it Janice? Janine, right. Come on, Cam. You barely know their names. Are you really going to look them up? Maybe. Anyway, sometimes she's not great with names, but that doesn't mean anything. After meeting Kathy, for instance, Cam kept wanting to call her something else. What exactly? She wasn't sure. It was just that Kathy didn't seem to fit right. Still, it's kind of surprising Cam had such a hard time with it, since Kathy is one of the most common names in that particular generation. Must have been the booze doing a number on her memory, since there were no pregnancy hormones to blame then. Soon enough, though, the hormones will be history. The next thing Cam knows, she'll be back on the playground with a new toddler in tow. There will be new moms to meet. Right. And they'll probably all be, quite literally, new moms. In their late 20s or early 30s, first-timer visitors to the insular world that revolves around Noggin, Go-Gurt, and Crayola mess-free finger paint. I've already been there. Done that. But it might be fun to go back. To do things differently this time around. Stress less. Linger more. Make new friends. You're going to need them, since you won't have a husband this time around. But she will have Tess. She'll be a big help. Or will she? She's never been around small children, and she's still pretty needy herself. Cam looks toward the beach access path, hoping to catch a reassuring glance of Tess, safely back with her ice cream. No sign of her yet. Cam shifts uneasily in her chair, as a sense of apprehension slips in to make her shiver in the hot sun. The binoculars will do nicely. The purchase was a success. After dark, the night vision feature can be tested, but it's sure to prove effective. Back into the shopping bag they go, along with the receipt. The amount paid in cash, of course. There will be no credit card to trace the buyer to the sporting goods superstore out on the highway. Nor, in the unlikely event that suspicions arise, will anyone ever be able to link a paper trail to the Texas Mail Order Company. No records at the Trenton Electronics store where an impressive-looking video camera just happened to be on sale last month, and not at the adjacent Home Depot, where there were a number of supplies to replenish, rope, duct tape, a flashlight, all bought at different times, from a different checkout cashier. Everything is safely tucked away. No need to bring any of it out here to the beach. The binoculars, though, are a different story. They needed to be tested to see whether they were worth the exorbitant price. Yes, well worth it. They really are as powerful as the salesman claimed. Perfect. Now all there is to do is wait for the right time. The shopping bag slips easily into the bottom of the beach bag, beneath a towel, a book, sunscreen, a hat, everything an ordinary beachgoer might need for an innocent day at the shore. Well, of course, when it comes to charades, I'm as skilled as, well, as she is. But in the end, every game has a winner and a loser. And I never lose. Chapter 8. Tess and Beth are still nowhere to be seen. Debbie is back at last, though, with a full plastic pitcher in her hand and a stack of plastic cups sticking out of her beach bag. Three of them. Why three? Cam wonders distractedly, her nerves on edge with Tess out of view.
Sorry it took forever. But how's this for chairside service? Debbie asks. Who needs cabana boys?
Oh. Cam realizes why Debbie brought a third cup. She isn't alone. Trailing behind her is a tall blonde in sunglasses, shorts, and a t-shirt. She's carrying a straw beach bag.
This is Gwen. Gwen, Cam.
Nice to meet you. Gwen politely extends a hand.
You too.
Shaking Gwen's right hand, Cam automatically checks the ring finger on her left. She's been doing that lately. Looking to see who's wearing a ring and who isn't. Around Debbie, ring fingers tend to be bare, as Gwen's is. Is she single? Gay? Divorced? Married, perhaps, but for whatever reason, not wearing a wedding band? My God, why do you care? Cam asks herself, annoyed. Again, she glances at the dunes. Where's Tess? Having settled into her own sand chair again, Debbie points to the empty seats that were quickly vacated by the kids.
Sit, Gwen.
Gwen sits. Debbie begins filling the plastic cups with white slush from the pitcher. Cam wants to stop her before she gets to the third, but she doesn't.
I'll just take it, she decides, and hold it, and dump it out gradually whenever no one's looking.
That's the easiest way to handle it, especially with a newcomer in their midst and her growing sense of uneasiness. She shouldn't have let Tess go get ice cream. She should have just said no. Yeah, that would go over about as well as insisting Tess wear floaties if she goes into the water. Cam tells herself Tess is probably fine and wishes she could push aside the unsettled feeling. To distract herself, she looks at Gwen again, sizing her up beyond the ring finger. For all Cam knows, her face might very well be gorgeous beyond the glasses, but her hair has slightly dark roots. She's got cellulite on her thighs and a faint network of varicose veins on her legs. Physical imperfection, a welcome sight, given Debbie's striking beauty and Cam's pregnancy weight gain.
What? No pineapple garnish and paper umbrella?
Gwen fake chides Debbie, who cheerfully gives her the finger.
So you guys just met?
Cam asks, a little taken aback by the easy rapport between them.
Oh, no. We knew each other back home years ago, Debbie replies.
What? You think I'd invite a perfect stranger to sit with us?
Sure I do, Cam thinks, amused.
Perfect strangers are exactly Debbie's style. For hanging out, for watching kids. Aloud, she says,
Wow, that's some coincidence.
What's a coincidence? Debbie asks.
That you two ran into each other here.
She tries not to look down at the cup in her hand. The sun is hot, and she's thirsty.
Not really. We're staying in the same house.
Careful not to spill her own drink, Gwen adjusts her chair back and kicks her flip-flops into the sand.
Really?
Cam raises her eyebrows.
That's an even bigger coincidence.
Didn't anyone ever tell you there are no real coincidences? Gwen asks with a grin. We're both renting it from a mutual old friend back home, Harry Myers. He's owned the house on Dolphin forever, Debbie adds. I used to come here with my parents and then later with what's-his-name.
Who?
Gwen asks.
My ex,
Debbie sips her drink, then adds, I don't like to say his name because it makes him sound human, and he's not. But it's Greg. Yeah, I know how that goes.
I've got a Greg of my own.
Gwen's divorced, too, Debbie informs Cam.
Two?
Does she mean Gwen's divorced like me? Or Gwen's divorced like us?
Cam wants to point out that she herself is merely separated, but she doesn't.
Again, she looks at the drink in her hand, wishing she could gulp it down, but only, she tells herself, because it looks refreshing and she's thirsty, not because there's rum in it and she's growing more tense by the second. She lowers the cup to the side of her chair, away from the others, and tilts it, allowing some of the white foam to run out into the sand.
So when did you say your daughter is coming out here?
Debbie asks Gwen, who is sipping her own drink.
Not until August. She's a junior counselor this year at a sleepaway camp in Maine.
What are you going to do with yourself alone out here for a month?
I'll keep busy, I'm sure, Gwen replies.
Cam said the same thing to Tess yesterday when she asked, yet again, what Cam is going to do all weekend without her.
Debbie nods and doesn't press Gwen, unlike Tess, who wanted to know exactly what Cam would do to keep busy while she was with her dad.
I'll read and go for walks. Maybe I'll go see Granddad play somewhere with his band, too, if she can track him down. Her father has been making himself pretty scarce lately. Or I'll just relax here. I'll be fine.
Tess didn't seem to believe that. Cam didn't believe it either.
Still doesn't, now that her lonely long weekend is looming. She just hopes it doesn't rain. Or maybe she should hope that it does. That way she can hole up in the cottage and pretend it's just another stormy day at the beach instead of a family holiday.
I swear, I'm so used to keeping busy, Gwen comments, that I don't think I'd know how to mope anymore if I wanted to.
There's the spirit. Debbie lifts her glass in a toast. Life's too short for moping. Maybe I'm lucky I have to work.
Well, I have to say, I wouldn't mind getting on a plane and flying away some days, Gwen says with a laugh.
Cam checks again to see if Tess is on her way back yet.
Nope.
How old is your daughter? She asks Gwen.
Casey's 15.
So she's spending the summer at camp?
Yeah. She says beaches are boring, and she wants to make money.
Gwen shakes her head.
How old is your daughter?
Tess is 14, like Beth.
Debbie, Cam has noticed, likes to answer questions for people. That might get annoying after a while. Right now, though, Cam would just as soon have her own personal spokesperson so she can focus on emptying her glass little by little and worrying about Tess. How long can it possibly take to get ice cream?
I guess Casey will have someone other than me to hang around with when she comes down in August, Gwen says.
You mean your daughter doesn't want to hang out with you 24/7?
Debbie asks dryly.
Imagine that.
Yeah, imagine.
Beth used to want to be with me all the time. Then she pretty much turned into my worst enemy.
You mean since your divorce? Gwen asks.
I mean since she hit puberty. She can be a little beast.
Can't they all? Gwen agrees.
Cam merely nods and keeps an eye on the beach access path, wishing Tess would reappear.
Wow, close call, huh? Beth asks as they hurry back to the beach.
Definitely. Your mother would have killed us if she saw.
Nah, Beth said. She wouldn't have been thrilled, but she wouldn't have killed us.
Well, she would have told my mother, and my mother would definitely kill me if she knew.
Good thing she doesn't know then, right? And she's not going to find out, so no big deal, right?
Beth flashes her a white, perfect smile.
Right, Tess tries to smile back. They made their way along the road, flip-flops slapping. Tess's are constructed of cheap rubber and plastic, bought at a drugstore in town. Mom felt so bad about what happened at Lily's party that she offered to replace the expensive pair Tess left behind there. But Tess didn't want her to. Every time she wore them, she'd only be reminded of that awful, humiliating day. It's not as if she doesn't still think about it. A lot. But sometimes she feels like it happened to someone else.
It's so freaking hot, Beth comments.
Yeah, we should go in the water.
You can, I'm not.
I bet it's not that cold.
Who cares about cold? There's sharks in there.
They're way out, though.
Uh-uh. My mother said a bunch of people got eaten by a great white really close to the shore on this beach.
A bunch of people? Tess asks, shuddering. Maybe she won't go in after all.
Maybe it was just two, but it was horrible.
When did it happen?
Like almost 100 years ago or something?
100 years ago? So you're not going to go in the water because there was a shark in it 100 years ago?
Nope. Beth lifts her glossy black hair away from her neck. No way. Sharks live a really long time. Are you going in?
Maybe. I mean, it's really hot.
Tess wipes a trickle of sweat from her forehead.
You're not afraid of sharks?
Not really. I guess I never thought about it.
Well, you should. You could die.
What are the odds of that?
Beth shrugs and they walk on in silence for a moment. Up here, away from the water, the briny air smells of hot asphalt, fried seafood, and last night's beer. Tess decides it's kind of sickening in this heat.
Oh, wait. Beth stops walking and grabs her arm. We need to get ice cream before we go back down. That way they won't get suspicious.
They might if we show up with, like, full ice cream cones. They'll know we just got them, because otherwise they'd be melted, and they'll wonder what we were doing for the past 20 minutes till now.
Good point. You should be a detective, Tess.
She can't help but feel flattered by Beth's approving nod. Unlike Lily and Morrow, Beth makes her feel good about herself, like she fits in, which she doesn't back home. Tess doesn't care if she never goes back to Montclair again, but that's not going to happen. Summer's going to end, and school's going to start, and she's going to be stuck seeing Lily and Morrow and Chad every day, knowing they're all laughing about her. Mom says by then they'll have forgotten all about it. But Tess knows better. They won't forget. Her worst nightmare, which was once her most fervent dream, would be to run into Heath Pickering here on Long Beach Island. So far it hasn't happened, but she keeps an eye out for him everywhere she goes, especially on the white wooden lifeguard stands that tower above the beach.
Okay, so we'll say we got ice cream and stayed up here and ate it, Beth decides. Right?
Right.
Cool, Beth sighs. I wish you weren't going away tomorrow. That sucks.
Yeah.
Can't you just tell your dad you don't want to go?
He'd feel bad, says Tess, who'd already considered and ruled out that idea.
So what? He's done plenty of stuff that makes you feel bad, right?
Not really.
Oh, come on. How about leaving you?
He didn't leave me. He left my mother.
He left both of you. And don't pretend it didn't make you feel bad because I've been there.
I thought you wanted your dad to move out. I thought you hated him.
Beth hesitates. Yeah, I did, she says. I mean, I do, and so does my mom. He's a worthless piece of crap.
Tess had heard Beth's mother say exactly the same thing about Beth's dad, in exactly the same harsh tone. No matter what her own father did, or does, Tess can't imagine talking about him that way. Either Beth's father is really, really horrible, or Beth's mother is really, really bitter. Maybe both. At least Mom never says anything bad about Dad, thank God. Tess gets the feeling she isn't even mad at him for leaving. And Dad doesn't seem mad at Mom, either. Divorces are supposed to be angry and bitter, right? That's how it's been for all her friends' parents. But Mom and Dad are just sad and wistful. Maybe that means there's hope. Maybe when Dad shows up tomorrow to pick up Tess, he and Mom will realize they're still in love and everything will get back to normal. And then what? We all live happily ever after? Oh, please.
Tess is disgusted by her naive, wishful thinking. She's not a little girl anymore, believing in fairy tales. The real world basically sucks. The older she gets, the more she realizes that. The sooner she stops holding out hope for her parents' marriage, the better it will be for everyone. Look at Beth. She's not sitting around pining for the good old days, though in Beth's case, the old days weren't very good, to say the least. But that doesn't matter.
What matters is that Beth has put the past behind her and moved on. I need to move on, too. I need to grow up.
Yeah, and the way things have gone so far, Tess has a feeling that being here this summer with Beth is going to accomplish that task pretty quickly.
Sitting across a weathered picnic table from Randy, Lucinda swats at a persistent fly that apparently didn't get its fill on her burger and is now buzzing around her funnel cake. More flies buzz around a nearby garbage can. The air is still and steamy. A stereo in a nearby house is blasting ancient Bon Jovi through the screens, and around the corner, by the condiments, some little kid is screaming because he dropped his hot dog in the dirt. Maybe Lucinda should have accepted Randy's invitation to an air-conditioned marina restaurant on the bay in Shipbottom, as opposed to this beachside grill in Beach Haven. But once she glimpsed the blue Atlantic beyond the dunes at the end of the side street, she decided she wanted to eat outside, by the water.
What better way to soak up the local atmosphere? She asked him.
You've been to Long Beach Island before, though, right?
Right, she said. But never with you.
And she isn't with him now, other than to eat lunch and fill him in on the case. So here they are, polishing off dessert, a mango water ice for Randy, and this golden, powdered sugar-dusted nest of deep-fried calories for Lucinda. She knows it's crap. She's pretty sure the day is going to come when she'll have to watch what she eats. But at 31, she can still put away anything she wants, and still wear size 6 jeans. The Sloanes have always been blessed with good metabolism. Some back in Philly would say the mainline Sloanes have always been blessed, period. Lucinda knows better.
So that's pretty much it, she says at last, having finished a running update on just about everyone she and Randy ever worked with back in the old days, before he fled.
That's it? You mean there's no more? He asks wryly.
No news on the desk sergeant's nephew's cleaning lady's gallbladder surgery?
She swats at Randy's brown arm instead of the fly.
Hey, I thought you asked how everyone was.
I did. I didn't expect you to tell me how everyone was.
You didn't seem bored.
You could never bore me.
Is he flirting with her?
Hard to tell. They're both wearing sunglasses. She can't see his striking blue eyes. That's probably a good thing. Those eyes always did get to her. The eyes, the dimples, the dark coloring, an exotic combination, courtesy of his Arabian father and Irish mother. Suddenly there's a rush of squawking birds, flapping wings and swooping low. Lucinda turns to see some tourists a few tables away, throwing crumbs from a big pretzel.
Idiots, she mutters, shaking her head and taking a big bite of her funnel cake.
Trying to finish that before they start using it for target practice? And I'm not talking with arrows.
Lucinda looks up in surprise to see Randy grinning at her.
Now who's the psychic? She asks, returning the grin.
Nah, not a psychic. I just know you well.
After all these years? That's pretty amazing.
What? That I knew you didn't want some bird crapping on your food? Or worse yet, your head?
Now, see, that wouldn't be so bad, she tells him, and pops the last morsel of funnel cake into her mouth.
Around a mouthful, she adds, I heard somewhere that it's good luck if a bird poops on you, and I could use some of that right about now.
Luck? Planning on heading down to Atlantic City from here?
She shakes her head.
Unfortunately, no.
So tell me about the case.
She brushes the powdered sugar off her hands and lap, then folds the grease-stained white paper plate in half.
It's not exactly dinner table conversation, if you know what I mean.
Randy, more than most people, does know what she means. With a nod, he says, Let's go for a walk on the beach and you can tell me about it.
A walk on the beach.
She considers making a joke about how romantic that sounds, then decides it would be inappropriate.
Inappropriate?
That's pretty much her mother's all-time favorite word. White shoes and handbags before Memorial Day and after Labor Day are inappropriate, Lucinda. So said the formidable Bitsy Sloane. Often. That and asking for a rum floater on a cocktail is inappropriate, Lucinda. And laughing at a bawdy joke is inappropriate, Lucinda. How about kidding around about romance with married men is inappropriate, Lucinda. Ha. Huh. She isn't in the mood to kid around, anyway. As they make their way down to the beach, she gives Randy the background on the Roby case. So, if you've had no leads in almost a month, Randy asks as they cross the dunes onto the wide golden strand, what brings you here? That. She sweeps her hand out toward the sea. The ocean? She nods, kicks off her black leather flats and bends to pick them up, scooping a handful of sand in the process. And this. She lets the fine grains run through her fingers, blowing away on the warm, coconut lotion-scented wind. Sand? She nods. The forensics team ran some tests on the little white box I told you about. You said it was empty. Pretty much. But there were grains of sand in it. They came from here. Long Beach Island? He looks dubious. You know that for an absolute fact? Let's put it this way. I know for an absolute fact that they came from a stretch of shoreline in this general region. And I feel they came from Long Beach Island. Randy's mouth quirks in recognition, and he nods. Gotcha. I knew you would. He always did believe in her gift, or at least gave her the benefit of the doubt. He was one of the few on the force who didn't question or ridicule her. That, well, after the dimples and blue eyes, was the first thing that captured her interest. They walk down the beach, sticking close to packed wet sand at the waterline, because the hot dry sand farther up scorches the soles of Lucinda's feet, and she insists on walking barefoot. She wishes she had on a bathing suit instead of black pants and a white short-sleeved blouse. At least she left her blazer in the car. Not Detective Randall Barricat. He's wearing a jacket, dress shirt, slacks, loafers. So you think that little girl is somewhere on the island? Randy asks. I'm not sure. I feel like she was.
Was?
Lucinda nods slowly.
So you're here to find her remains?
I'm here to blanket this island with missing child posters that have Leah Roby's picture on them, and hope that somebody saw something and will recognize her. I'm here to find whoever took her before they strike again.
And you think, I mean, you feel like he's somewhere on the island?
Lucinda nods again. There isn't a doubt in her mind.
How long are you staying?
The question gives her pause. Truthfully, she has no idea. She figured just for the afternoon, but now that she's here, as long as it takes, she hears herself say. The late afternoon sun has slid low on the horizon, and a steady stream of beachgoers head toward the dunes. Bedraggled, sun-toasted, wrapped in damp towels, people lug chairs, umbrellas, coolers, and boogie boards over the sand. Air conditioning, aloe, herbal shampoo, dry clothes, deck grills, cold drinks await. Straw tote over her shoulder and folded sand chair in hand, Cam walks toward the access path with Debbie and Gwen. Trailing behind with a shovel and a sloshing bucket full of shells and sea life is Jonathan. Leading the way are Tess and Beth, colorful towels tied low, sarong style, around their waists, their heads close together as they chat intensely about whatever it is teenaged girls chat intensely about. Boys, if memory serves Cam. Clothes, music. Some things, she suspects, never change. Cam is glad Tess has found a summer friend, even if she does look about 17 and is a whole head taller than Tess, who from here could be a scrawny little girl beside Beth. Cam wonders if Tess is reluctant to leave tomorrow with Mike, or maybe she's looking forward to a change of scenery. Cam would welcome one right about now. She could always head back to Montclair for the weekend herself. But what would I do there? At least here, there's the beach, and Debbie. And Gwen, for that matter, whom Cam found herself inviting to get together over the weekend for a movie or a walk. "We can keep each other company," she said casually.
"What about me?" Debbie asked.
"You've got your kids," Gwen piped up. "That would cramp our style." Cam couldn't see her eyes behind her sunglasses, but her mouth was grinning slyly.
"Listen, Jonathan has his heart set on mini-golf, and I've been putting him off. You two have to come with us."
"Why don't you just make Beth take him?" Cam asked, and added, but only to herself, "or find a hired woman to do it."
"Are you kidding? Beth is much too cool for mini-golf."
"So am I," Cam said with a grin. "But the truth is, she's on her own this weekend at the shore for the first time. By this time tomorrow, mini-golf might actually sound appealing. Or maybe she'll go through all those notebooks, which she stashed on the top shelf of the bedroom closet, where Mike used to keep his golf shoes."
"Don't forget, you're both coming to my barbecue this weekend," Debbie informs them now. "Day after tomorrow."
"Is that an order?" Gwen asks.
"Absolutely, so mark your calendars."
"That'll be the only thing on mine," Cam says wryly.
"Mine too, pretty much," Gwen agrees. "What time is your ex-husband picking up your daughter tomorrow morning?"
Cam doesn't correct her on the ex. "It's just semantics," she tells herself, even though it bothers her.
"About 7:30, he said.
"At that ungodly hour," Debbie says, "you should shove her out the door, roll over, and go back to sleep."
Cam nods, wishing it could be that simple. Maybe that's why she's been on edge all day, even after Tess safely returned from her ice cream mission. Tomorrow, she'll come face to face with Mike. Tomorrow will either be the beginning of a new chapter in their marriage, or the end of the final one.
"Let's get cleaned up and go out to dinner," Debbie suggests. "I'm dying for a steak."
"That sounds good," Gwen agrees. "I'm in."
"Cam?
With the kids?"
"Are you kidding? G-N-O.
"Don't you mean N-O? Gwen asks. "Or is the G silent?"
"You goof. I mean G-N-O, girls' night out. We'll get the kids some pizza and a movie and leave them at my house."
"It's my last night with Tess."
"Ever?"
Debbie asks flippantly, and Cam wants to tell her that isn't funny.
Not at all.
But she forces a smile anyway, telling herself she's overreacting. "Tess is fine, safe and sound. Nothing bad is going to happen to her."
"Tess," Debbie calls. "Hey, Tess, come here."
Tess turns, then trots agreeably toward them.
"Would you rather go out to dinner with me and your mom and Gwen, or have pizza and a movie at my place with Beth and Jonathan and maybe Tyler and Ryan if they're not staying with their dad tonight?"
Tyler and Ryan are her friend Petra's kids. Tyler is 13, tall for his age. Cam heard Beth call him a hottie.
"Are you kidding?" Tess lights up. "Pizza and a movie?"
"And the hottie," Cam sighs inwardly. Debbie directs a slightly smug expression at her.
"Great, we're all set. I'll call Petra when I get home."
"You know, I really thought you were going to stand me up tonight," Kate comments, setting her nearly empty wine glass back on the white tablecloth.
Mike forces himself to look her in the eye.
"Really? Why did you think that?"
"Because you didn't return my call or my email until the end of the day."
Kate leans back in her chair and folds her arms across her black designer bodice. Her left wrist, encircled by a watch that costs about the same as a year of Tess's school tuition, is positioned on top, probably deliberately, as if that would impress him.
"Either you were completely unreachable, or you wanted to leave me hanging," Kate tilts her head. "Which was it?"
"Which do you think?"
"In your business, you can't afford to be unreachable."
"That's what I think."
Mike wonders what to say to that, then realizes he doesn't have to say anything at all. He doesn't owe anything to this woman, this stranger with her bony bare shoulders and pale city skin, black eyeliner, and fancy perfume that smells nothing like the one he bought for Cam on their anniversary. He asked Kate out the first time, a few weeks ago, because it seemed like a good idea to start dating.
"You might as well," is how his friend Tony, on his second marriage, put it.
For some reason, Mike listened to him.
"You might as well? Is that ever a good reason to do anything?"
He slept with her for the same reason, just once, because she was willing, and it had been a while. Yes, he knew it was wrong from the first kiss, but he wasn't thinking with his brain at that point. Afterward, he couldn't get out of there fast enough. He found his discarded clothes beside her bed, threw them on in the dark, and left. He might never have seen her again if he hadn't stupidly forgotten to check and make sure his wallet hadn't dropped out of his pants pocket onto the floor. He had to meet her the next day to get it back. She made him feel so guilty for running away in the night that he wound up asking her out again.
"You're an ass," Mike tells himself, buttering another hot roll from the basket on the table.
Then, realizing what he's doing, he sets it on his plate. Mike doesn't want a roll. He's had his fill.
"Our appetizers should be here by now. Where's the waiter?" Kate asks, looking around impatiently.
Mike doesn't want to date her. He's had his fill. If they hadn't already ordered their meals, he'd be tempted to cut this short right now. But that would be complicated, and anyway, after the way he ran out on her the one night they slept together, he's determined to be a gentleman now. Okay, so he'll share this last dinner with Kate, then see her to her building's lobby with the taxi meter running. Then what? Go home to his empty apartment downtown. He can't think of anything more depressing.
"Waiter? Excuse me?"
Kate waves her hand, fancy watch gleaming. Well, there is one thing more depressing than going home alone. Finding himself in Kate's bed. He pushes the thought from his mind. Never again. At this hour of the night, with traffic thinning, he could make it down to Beach Haven in a couple of hours. Be there before midnight. It's tempting. But not a good idea. Better to start fresh in the morning, as planned. He'll get up early, drive to the shore, and see his daughter. And his wife.
Don't you mean soon-to-be ex-wife?
Maybe not. What if he told Cam it was all a big mistake? That he was wrong? That he'd give anything for a second chance? What would she say? There's only one way to find out. No one argued with Cam when she volunteered to be the designated driver tonight. A brilliant move. She can sip Pellegrino in peace as Debbie, Gwen, and Petra drink red wine and trash their ex-husbands. Well, Debbie has done most of the talking, alluding to Greg's other women, a gambling problem, and a string of lost jobs. No wonder she has to work. Now, as dinner winds down, she announces, "Dolores will be around this weekend, so you guys will have to let me know what you think of her."
"Who's Dolores?" asks Petra, a heavy-set brunette with bleached blonde hair and a smoker's deep voice.
"She's the one who's taking care of my kids while I'm gone. They all need to get used to each other before I go flying away after the weekend."
"Where'd you find her?"
"I actually met her walking down the street. We started talking and she said she was looking for work."
Gwen is incredulous. "You just happened to meet a nanny walking down the street?"
"Not a nanny. She's just a hired woman."
Cam sighs inwardly, wishing she were home with Tess, grateful when the check arrives.
"Someone figure out how much we each owe,"
Debbie commands as they all reach for their purses.
"I stink at math."
"I'll do it." Gwen opens her large wallet, revealing a slim calculator tucked into a pocket.
"You're totally equipped," Debbie marvels.
"That's because I stink at math, too. Not to mention I can't see very well in my old age." Gwen removes a clear plastic rectangle, places it over the bottom of the bill,
and presses a little button that lights it up.
Whoa, what's that, a fancy magnifying glass?
Petra peers over Gwen's shoulder.
What else have you got in that wallet of yours?
Gwen laughs. Just the usual, driver's license, credit cards, pictures of my daughter.
Ooh, let's see.
Gwen passes around a school photo of a girl with dark braids and glasses.
That's Casey.
Cute, Petra says approvingly.
Want to see Tyler and Ryan?
Sure. Petra fishes in her own wallet for pictures of her boys as Cam sneaks a peek at her watch. She was hoping to spend some time with Tess, but by the time they get home, it'll be time for bed, since Mike will be there early tomorrow. And I need to figure out what I'm going to say to him and how I'm going to say it. Of course, Debbie has to show off several pictures of Beth and Jonathan, and they all want to see one of Tess.
You know, she really looks nothing like you, Gwen comments.
I know, Cam says, longing to just get moving. People say that all the time. She looks just like my husband.
Ex-husband, Debbie corrects.
Not really. We're just separated.
Cam hates the knowing look the other three share.
At last, the photos are back where they belong, the check is paid, and Cam digs for her car keys as they head for the door. The moment they're out in the steamy night air, Petra lights up a cigarette.
Sorry, she says, fanning the smoke away from the others. Been at it since I was 12, and I can't quit. I've tried. Do you guys mind waiting a few minutes before we get into the car?
No, that's fine,